Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer recruiting experts. Now, here's your host, Chris Cousins.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. This is Chris Cousins, the founder of Sports Recruiting USA, and this is Inside College Soccer Podcast. Well, episode number 3, and it's a good one this time. We have one of the world's leading sports psychologists, if not the world's leading, but he's definitely up there, Dan Abrahams. He's given up a couple of hours of his time to answer a lot of questions, give a lot of gold, a lot of knowledge. On the podcast, I'm joined by Don Williams, who's my colleague based in California, so he does my kind of my role, but in the US. So he joined in because he's a massive fanboy of Dan, and he's kind of the reason why we're kind of connected with this. And he met him at a convention a while back, and yeah, the relationship went from there. So Dan is actually on our advisory board with the sports psychology side of things, and we've helped get him into a lot of colleges in the US, and he's helped a few of our players out and stuff like that. He's a great knowledge. He's got great knowledge. He's a great guy, and yeah, it's a privilege having him on the advisory board and obviously this podcast. So yeah, we've got a few questions that were sent into it. So we've tried to answer the majority of them in some way possible. Obviously, some questions we couldn't really fit in, but apologies about that. But appreciate everyone kind of expressing interest in this podcast. So yeah, really excited about this one. Obviously, number 3, getting a lot of traction with our podcasts. We try to do things a little bit different outside the box and try to get people who are obviously going to add value to your commute, or I don't know, whether you just sit down and listen to this in the living room or driving, working out. Hopefully, you don't have to listen to me for too long. All right, awesome. Yeah, so here we have Dan Abrahams, one of the world's leading sports psychologists, and this is the Inside College Soccer Podcast. Dan, thanks for coming on the Inside College Soccer Podcast. Really appreciate it. Joining me is Don Williams, who's the head of operations in North America, so the meat of North America. So both of us, really interested in what you do. And I've followed your content for many years, Don, more so. He definitely is a big advocate, and is the reason we're probably speaking right now, actually. So really thanks for your time, for coming on today, and hopefully this will be very useful to people listening. So yeah, probably the first question that's probably the most obvious, but like, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and obviously, well, not obviously, but where you've come from and how you've got to where you are as one of the world's leading sports psychologists.
Well, thanks, Chris. I mean, firstly, thank you very much for inviting me on. It sounds like Don likes me much more than you do, so that's okay. That's all right.
Like you a little bit more, if that's okay.
Well, I'll try. Maybe this podcast will change it. I'll see what I can do today. I mean, no pressure.
To be honest, Dan, I'm a little starstruck, you know, I was from the first time I reached out to you, first time I saw you, room packed, standing room only, and standing ovation at the end, and yeah, so I'm very excited to have this conversation with you. Appreciate it.
No, I'm delighted to be on, and it's an honor to join up with you guys. I mean, as your audience might know, I'm involved with the company now and enjoying working with you guys. So it's always good to chat through this stuff. Well, who am I? I'm a former professional golfer. I failed miserably to make any money from golf. And as I always say in these kind of introductions, largely my golf failed because of what was going on between my two ears. I would see the bunker in the trees and the rough and all the bad stuff rather than the fairway. And I would look at other people's golf swings and think about how much better theirs was than mine, which probably wasn't actually that true. I had quite a good golf swing, right? So I finished playing golf, and I coached the game for a bit. And as I was coaching, I always liked the psychological side of sport, and obviously at that time golf. So I was an avid reader of sports psychology books from the age of 15. quite a sad teenager, clearly. It kind of built from there. And as I was coaching, I got more into it. And I made the decision to do a degree in psychology and a master's degree in sports psychology as I was coaching golf. And then I really got to a stage about 15 years ago. Do I stay as a golf coach and have the sports psychology on the side, or do I go full out and become a registered sports psychologist here in England, have supervision and become registered? And so I chose the latter because I was really keen to work in other sports. I was just starting to feel that coaching in golf alone wasn't going to fulfill me enough. So that's what I did. And obviously I knew golf like the back of my hand. And as your audience might know, as a sports psychologist, of course, you can work in any sport. You know, you can work across all sports. But I was also quite keen to have what I would describe as specialisms. So I knew golf like the back of my hand. And then I was kind of thinking, well, what other sport could I get involved with as a sports psychologist that I could really specialize with, really learn the language of the sport and learn the specific challenges that players within that sport face? Because I think every sport has its unique language, it has its unique challenges and unique way that people talk and go about what they're striving to do. So I was always a big soccer fan, kind of, because I was a Spurs fan growing up, and that was quite torturous, supporting Tottenham Hotspur in the 90s, because they weren't.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Dan. I apologize for that.
Yeah, no, that was quite painful. Not been so bad the last few years.
Could be a Bradford City supporter.
Oh, well, yes. That's. I remember when Bradford City were in the Premier League for a season.
Actually, yeah, during the 90s. Yeah, we do better than you in the 90s, actually.
Yes, exactly. They were the mighty Bradford City in the 90s. So, I knew soccer reasonably well as an armchair supporter, but I thought, okay, I'd really like to get involved with soccer. And so I began at the beginning, really, as you do, and I started to get involved in non-league. You know, I worked for free in non-league, and we're very fortunate. One of my first appointments was with a gentleman, a coach called Wayne Burnett, who is now the under-23s coach at Spurs, funnily enough. And he was a brilliant coach at the time. And I remember it was with a club called Dulwich Hamlet and then Fisher Athletic. And Fisher Athletic were in the sixth division, the Blue Square South, as it was called back then. And we had a bunch of players who had come down from being in the Arsenal Academy and the West Ham Academy and some top academies. And we had an incredible season, and I really learned a lot. And at that time, I got introduced to a player called Carlton Cole, if everybody remembers him. He used to play for West Ham. He was at Chelsea before that. So I worked with him, and he did a lot of really good hard work on the mental side of his game and developed to the point where he actually went from languishing in the West Ham reserves to England international. Fabio Capello called him up. And then sort of other West Ham players latched onto it and started to work with some Spurs players and QPR players and across the board. And so I suppose since then, I've been working away behind the scenes very quietly, very confidentially a lot of the time, with very fortunate really guys to have worked with some of the best soccer players, men's and women's, girls and boys, globally. I've had contracts at Fulham, West Ham, QPR. I was at Derby County working alongside Steve McLaren. I was at Nigel Pearson as well. And now I'm at AFC Bournemouth, working there through the medical department, working with Eddie Howe. Got a number of individual players I work with in the Premier League, some of whom played Champions League. But working with all ages, working, as I say, I work with a lot of American players, work with a lot of colleges, and written a few books as well, Soccer Tough, Soccer Tough 2, and Soccer Brain. And then just several years ago, I think final thing to say here, I was asked if I could further try to bring to life, I mean, my passion is to demystify sports psychology for soccer players and soccer coaches and soccer parents. And I wanted to create a platform, an online platform to help players, coaches and parents work together on the mental side of the game. And so I produced the Dan Abraham Soccer Academy, which is a bunch of animated videos to help players, coaches, and parents work together on the mental side of the game. It also supports them through weekly emails. And so that's where I am, and that's my relationship with you guys as well. I think we had a dozen or so colleges who signed up to the Dan Abraham Soccer Academy of August, so they've been using it this season quite successfully, I'm quite pleased to say. So that's where I am. I work on this quite hard, and I was just, I suppose this is absolutely the final thing to introduce, guys. I've been lead psychologist for England Golf. I've been lead psychologist for England Rugby. I mean, obviously the Rugby World Cup has just been and gone, and I was fortunate enough to work alongside Eddie Jones. He's a very prominent Australian coach working with England Rugby, which was an experience, to say the least, that really helped me improve what I do. And I work across sports as well. So, yeah, is that comprehensive enough, or have I missed anything?
Yeah, I mean, you make me feel
now.
Inferior, Dan.
No, not at all. I think everyone's
I'm only kidding. It's brilliant. No. I was writing it all down as well. I was like, because some things that I didn't realise, actually. Obviously, this is a college soccer podcast, but it's kind of a thing for anyone to listen to. I mean, looking at who's been listening to the podcast, we've had quite a lot more listeners than I thought we would to start off with, especially with me at the helm. We've had like coaches from obviously within America, but outside of the US, a lot actually. We've had players, we've had just random people listening. So, Well, you just mentioned there about like you're working with some college teams, kind of not to kind of plug the academy. I know a little bit about it, but what are you doing with the college teams then? Like this academy thing here, how is it helping these players? Kind of, I'm not saying give us a detailed breakdown so that no one has to pay for it. I'm not saying even anyone do that, but just kind of give some information about that, just to how people can understand it.
Yeah, no, and it look, let's be clear, it's not so much about plugging the academy. My passion is to, as I said earlier, to demystify sports psychology for soccer players and coaches, because obviously we're talking about colleges here, so that's mainly players and coaches, right? And I'm really passionate about a college program having a mental skills framework or a mental skills curriculum to what they're doing. You know, my question to coaches is, when your players go and compete, do they have a mental skills framework? Every single one of your players, if you were to ask them, what are you trying to achieve mentally on the pitch, are they able to say, coach, I'm trying to do A, B, C? And then are they able to articulate how they're going to do that? Coach, I'm going to do this, this, and this to achieve A, B, and C. You know, for me, that is a critical essential. If you don't have that, then you're not optimizing not giving your players the very best opportunity to high perform more consistently under pressure. Players need a mental framework, mental skills. That's what I'm passionate about. And that is what the academy offers. But that's what I do whenever I work with a player. So if I'm working with a player at Bournemouth, if I'm working with a player, one of my clients played in the Champions League final over the summer. And I won't say who he is or which team it was on, but you know, this player had a game face going into this massive, massive global game with billions of people watching. He had a game face. He was using controllers. He was striving to squash his ants. So there were three things he was trying to do mentally. And let me tell you this, Chris and Dom, let me tell you this, is that what was imperative for him is that he put mindset first. So going into one of the biggest games in the world, one of the biggest games in professional football, professional soccer, his number one objective was something to do with his mental skills. It was to execute his game face no matter what, no matter the score, no matter how he was playing, no matter who he was playing, no matter how the opposition were playing, no matter how his teammates were playing. His job was to self-regulate, to manage himself, to get in his best performance state and to stay there no matter what. And to me, that has to be number one. It has to be number one because you know, because the game is so tough, the nature of the game, the fact that the opposition can be playing very, very well, and that's tough to manage. The fact that our brains and nervous systems can tend to be negative. They can tend to bookmark failure. They can tend to hang on to mistakes, because a big challenge in soccer is to get into your right performance state and stay there no matter what. That's absolutely imperative. So that to me is so, it's so important. It's so important that players, no matter their level, and I think college, you know, college is a time when we really are thinking about performance, aren't we? We really are thinking about outcomes. Our job is to win games. Yep, we want to develop players. And as we develop players, then we give ourselves a better opportunity to win games. But ultimately, when players set foot on the pitch in college games, we want to get into those playoffs. We want to do well in those playoffs, and ultimately we want to win. How do we do that? My argument is that we need a mental skills framework for each individual and for the team as a whole. And when we have that, that promotes great conversation between coaches and players to do with the mental side of the game. That creates great conversation amongst players to do with the mental side of the game. They become a student of the mental side of the game. They become a student of the mental side of the game and their mental side of the game. That's so imperative. And that gives us a better chance to high perform, and that gives us a better chance to win more games, in my opinion. It starts with the mental side. And that's what the academy does. That's what I do every day. That's what I preach. That's what I promote. Some coaches might disagree with that. That's fine. That's an interesting conversation, an interesting debate to have. But that's really what the academy tries to do, is when I talk to college coaches, I say, come on, let's build a world-class mental skills framework for your players. Let's build a world-class environment where players are passionate about talking about mental skills, where you are reinforcing mental skills every day, every day, every day, in every activity, whether it be rondo, keep ball, small-sided games, passing activity, whatever it is, every activity, you are reinforcing mental skills. I think that's absolutely imperative.
So what you mentioned a few things there, and there might be a lot of people who don't know what these are, but like, what's the game face? What's squashing your ants? What's that sort of thing there? Just kind of briefly, without obviously going too deep into it.
I don't mind talking a lot about it, because I think what I would say is, the one thing when I'm involved with players, it's actually, and coaches and programs, my job is a sense maker. What the academy does is sense making. You know, you can take random techniques, you know, and I think coaches can be guilty of this. They'll read a book here, a chapter here from a book, another book over there, and they've got this mishmash. That in essence, Chris is, and Don, is my big argument here, is that we can, I know some coaches are really passionate about the mental side of the game. They're great and they're brilliant and they're great coaches, but they tend, if I may say, to have a bit of a mishmash of ideas. And I'm passionate about articulating a specific mental skills framework. So absolutely, I could talk about a game face and squash ants, but it's about bringing them together. I suppose that's where my skill set and where the academy lies, and that's where the academy can be so useful, is it's helping coaches make sense of this. So there's a repeatable system in place. Let me tell you, so to a game face, and I know a lot of coaches listening in who do know of my work would have heard me talk about the game face, whether it's at the convention every year in January, or whether it's on other podcasts or articles I've done historically. But a game face is basically the personality that you want to be on the pitch. Your high performance mental state. It's who you want to be. It's a linguistic representation of who you want to be. So as an example, and I'm not giving anything away here with this player who went into the Champions League final back on June 1st this year, 2019, his game face is very simple. Relentless and dominant, relentless and dominant. Relentless and dominant because when I first sat down with this player and I asked this player, tell me about you at your best, which is a really important question for coaches to ask. because success leaves clues, and champions are really good at honing in on these successful clues. And so thinking about you at your best every day is a really useful thing to do. Comparing you to Lionel Messi, that's not what I'm saying, but it does help you to be a student of your mental game. So when we were talking about this player at his best, and when I also asked him about his dream game, he said, Dan, I'm dominant in the air, I'm dominant in the challenge, I'm dominant getting up the pitch, back down the pitch into the fence, I'm dominant with my body language, I feel dominant out there. And he said he was relentless as well, relentless checking for space, relentless getting back into position, etc., etc. So he talked about more stuff, but we eventually boiled it down to these two words, relentless and dominant, or dominant and relentless. And so that's his game face. That's his game face. And so he strives to embody that game face in every game. And now he has something to come back to all the time. So if he's not on his best, and this is where a game face is so important, guys, if he's not on his A game, his 9 out of 10 or his 8 out of 10 game, and perhaps he's feeling a bit flat, a bit lethargic, he warms up, he has those negative thoughts, and that's where ANTS come in, ANTS, which is an acronym for A, is for automatic, N for negative, T for thought. If he experiences some ANTS, because we experience ANTS, right, they happen to us, instead of being a slave to his ANTS, he now does something with them. Specifically, he squashes his ANTS. How? He gets back to his game face. So he talks to himself about being relentless and dominant, and he starts to embody being relentless and dominant. And that refers to your using your controllers. Okay, I call them controllers, which is your self-regulation techniques. And so this player, this is the beauty of this, guys, is that, and I'm sure every coach listening in will agree with me, the biggest key here is consistent high performance under pressure. What kills coaches, what winds up coaches, is the player who comes on and plays 8 out of 10 one week, 5 out of 10 the next week, 7 out of 10, 4 out of 10, 8 out of 10, 6 out of 10, 4 out of 10, 9 out of 10. It just drives coaches insane. What this player can now do, if he feels flat, if he feels lethargic, if he's suffering from a low mood, if the attitude isn't quite there, if his confidence isn't quite there, that's a really important thing to say. If the certainty isn't quite there, if the confidence, now I know you guys both played to a reasonably good level, there must have been times when you were warming up and you were kind of starting to have these answers, oh, I'm just not on it today, I'm just not feeling it, I'm just not there, I don't feel sharp, I don't feel alert or alive, I'm not. So you're having these ants, you've got to do something with them. So this player can squash his ants, get back to relentless and dominant, or dominant and relentless. And in that way, what it's not guaranteeing that he can have a 9 out of 10 game in that instance, but it is turning your 4s into 6s, your 5s into 6s, your 5s into 7s, your 6s into 7 out of 10. It's maximizing the game that you can have on the pitch. It's also turning the 7s into 8s and maybe the 8s into 9s. That's the idea, is driving consistent high performance under pressure. How? Because this player has the framework to take charge of himself, to own himself, his own mindset, to dominate himself, to be able to dominate the game, to take charge of himself, to take charge of the game. And that's why it's got to become number one. That game face is number one. What am I trying to achieve on the pitch? I'm trying to be dominant and relentless. I'm going to be dominant and relentless nonstop. Nothing and no one takes me away from dominant and relentless. Just imagine, Chris, if we had been working together when you had a scholarship, right? Didn't you? You were a scholarship.
I had ants in my pants.
Right, exactly, man. And it makes your feet sticky. It makes you lethargic. It gives you tunnel vision. So you're not seeing the 360 degree around you. You're not going to act quickly. So your anticipation slows. Your decision-making is going to suffer. It's not going to help you be the best that you can be, no matter what that looks like on that day. So Whereas if we'd been working together back then, okay, back in, I don't know, when was it, 1980s, 1970s?
Before World War II sometime.
Yeah, no. So if we were working together a decade ago, whenever it was, Chris, we would have been working hard on creating a narrative Monday to Friday, going into your game at the weekend. What is my job on the pitch? It's to be in my game. For example, dominant. I am going to be dominant and relentless nonstop, no matter what. Now, if I was to take you back a decade when actually you were at college probably, and I was working with Carlton Cole, and I can talk about this because I wrote this in my first book, Soccer Tough, and it's actually a case study on the academy. So we've got case studies on the academy. And when Carlton made his debut for England, he made his debut against the world champions. The world champion, Spain, at the time. There was Xavi on the pitch. There was Iniesta on the pitch. Now, what happens, Carlton, he was on the bench. And Fabio Capello had said to him before the game, he said, Carlton, I'm going to play you. You know, you will have a game. And so 75th minute, Fabio Capello gets up, big imposing figure, turns around, beckons Carlton, gets Carlton down. So he comes down, piece of crap just coming off. But he's standing on the side of the pitch, and it was so easy for him to have a whole pile of ants. But he was thinking two things, one of which I cover in the book, the other of which I cover in the academy. In the book, I talk about head, shoulders, knees, toes. When I was working with Carlton, if you remember that song that you sing at school, head, shoulders, knees, toes, yeah? So yeah. I correlated that to kind of the body, the embodiment that he wanted to have on the pitch. Get your head up, shoulders up. On your toes. So he was doing that. He also at that time had a game face, and this is what I talk about in the academy on one of the videos. He had a game face of aggressive monster. So it was really easy to have, as you would say, Chris, ants in his pants. And to be fair, he did have ants, because everybody has ants in moments like that. Ants aren't a bad thing. It's just we want to turn down the volume of ants. When I say squash ants, we want to turn down the volume of ants. And so this is what Carlton was doing. How was he doing it? Aggressive monster. I'm going to get out there, be aggressive monster. He wasn't giving in to those automatic negative thoughts. Thoughts happen to you. He wasn't giving in to those thoughts of don't mess up. Oh my God, Iniesta's on that pitch. Xavi's on that pitch. Oh, don't look a fool. Oh, don't let myself down. Oh, what will people think if I let down? The kind of thoughts we tend to have under pressure, he refused to give in to that. And he kept himself up. He went out there, aggressive monster. And he played well for the 15 minutes that he had. You know, he maximised his game. And that's what that's all about, that game face. Maximised.
And he had a good career, right? Has he recently retired?
Yeah, he has. You know, look, he went on and he did fine. And, you know, don't forget, he went from Claudio Ranieri, who was manager of Chelsea when Carlton was in the academy, and he was scoring something like 30, 40 goals. He said, Carlton's my lion. Carlton's going to be the next best striker in Europe. And he kind of didn't kick on like a lot of young players don't. And he found himself languishing in the West Ham reserve team. So ultimately, Carlton had about a dozen or so caps for England. And I think that's something he should be really, really proud of. And he became a bit of a West Ham legend, helping them get back up from Championship back up into the Premier League. You know, so that's really important. And I think the final thing to say there is, the narrative is this. Yes, my job on the pitch is to strive to play at my best, but it's also to strive to get the best from my play. I'm going to repeat that because that's really important to understand. And that's something I'm saying to my clients who play in the Premier League every single week. My job on the pitch is to play at my best. Think of an 8 out of 10 or a 9 out of 10 game. And my job is to get the best from my play. So if I am having a day, I'm a human being. I've got 400 bones in my body. I've got an opposition who might be on their 9 out of 10 game. I've got teammates who might not be playing that well. There's so many variables, many of which are out of my control. It's okay if I'm having a day where 6 out of 10 is the best I can do. But I've got to stick to my high performance mindset to get the best from my play. So I give myself the best opportunity to worst way have 6 out of 10. And if there is a secret to football, if there is a secret to high level sport, it is that. It is that narrative there. If there is a secret, it's getting out of our own way when our own way is this notion of being socialized into outcome and performance. Gotta win, gotta win, gotta win, gotta win. Gotta perform, gotta perform, gotta perform, gotta perform. No, stop. I want to get the best from my, I want to have my best possible performance, and I want to get the best from my play. I do that by having my best mindset. It is absolutely imperative that when I walk onto that pitch, when I run onto the pitch, I have my mental framework in place, and I'm going to execute a 10 out of 10 high performance mindset, or as close to 10 out of 10 high performance mindset as possible. I have to be tough on that and tolerant on my performance. When so all the other soccer players are so good at reversing that, they're too tough on their performance and too tolerant on their mindset. We've got to be much tougher on our mindset, more so than on our performance. In that way, we get the best possible performance we can have on any given day.
So, yeah. So Dan, I look at, man, you've said a lot there. There's a whole lot going on. See, I'm looking at this from a perspective of a former college coach, you know, 22 years in the NCAA and AIA and junior college and having coached some pretty good players. And there's a lot going on here. One of the things that you said early on, you used the term mental skills. So as a coach, that brings to mind, you know, skills being something that has to be practiced, like not once a week, but on a daily basis, something that has to be approached on a daily basis. If you could give our listeners out there that are involved in soccer a tip, like this is something you can practice on a daily basis. And I know that's broad, so let me bring that down to something that you mentioned, the mental pessimism that we all have. I think from an evolutionary standpoint, you know, we've evolved to look for threats, right? To look around the corner for every threat possible. And if the threats aren't real, then we tend to make them up and create threats that aren't real. So maybe to narrow it down from the perspective of squashing those ants, getting rid of that mental pessimism, or at least, as you said, quieting it, is there a skill? Is there something that we can do that we can practice on a daily basis?
The skill of using self-talk to be in my game face to squash my ants. If I was to speak to any coach and I say, here is your bottom line or your foundation of mental skills, I'm going to use Dan Abraham's colloquialism, but that's, you get what you get when you work with individuals. You get psychologist colloquialism, so you get mine. Ants, game face, controllers. One of the controllers is self-talk. Use your self-talk to squash your ants and get back to your game face. Okay, so Chris, when you were playing, if let's say your game face was confident and relentless, let's just hypothesize that. If you had your ants in your pants, you've got to use your self-talk, talk to yourself to squash your ants to get back to confident and relentless. And that's as basic as, you know, if you start to feel lethargic, okay, you feel it, and that shapes your ants. Oh, I'm feeling flat. Oh, I'm not feeling good today. No, stop. Come on, confident, relentless. Let's get back to confident, relentless. Show everybody here confident, relentless. Let's get back on that ball, confident, relentless.
How do you do that? It's easy saying that, because I'm trying to like visualize. I'm up for a game now if anyone wants to play. I'm up for it, right? Listen to all this. But like, how do you do that? So you're saying that, because I used to go through them stages. I used to, like, before a match, I was like, oh, man, I'm not feeling it today. And that then was become a vicious circle in my head.
Yeah, well, look, at, I mean, there's two ways, and because there's two controllers, and this is the key with the controllers. And quite often what you find with players is controller number one is enough. You say, how do I do that? I can think of I can't name names, but I can think of a pretty good player at the moment I'm working with who plays in the Premier League who says to me every week, Dan, I used my self-talk and it was awesome. I just talked to myself through the game. And if he said to me this weekend, I gave a few passes away. That was okay. I just kept talking to myself. Whereas historically, he said that historically he allowed his ants to suppress him. So he had that, you know, sometimes in psychology, we call it a negative thought chain. So one ant leads to another ant until you and leads to another ant, and then you've got an ant's nest or an ant's farm, right? It's like, I'm not playing today. I'm going to get subbed off. If I get subbed off, I might not get back in the team. If I don't get back in the team, what am I doing and why am I bothering with this? Should I even be playing soccer? And it can literally get that bad, right, on the pitch. So you need to squash it as quickly as possible. And that's a skill. So let's come back to what you were asking, Don, in terms of it being a skill. This is where coaches, and perhaps this is globally as coaches, we need to be better at bringing these into our activities on a day-by-day basis. You know, we sit down as coaches and we write out our activities. We write out what we want to do. Here's this rondo. Here's this keep ball. Here's this passing activity. Here's an activity to do with passing with progression. Here's a bit of shape work, whatever it is. But we don't think about the mental skills that we want to envelope into the activity. Now, for me, and I think even more of a bonus here, even better tip, and this is this actually happens to be a lot of the conversations I'm having with the college coaches who have signed up to the academy, is you want to be adding these skills, squashing the ants, using game face, using self-talk as an example, in your activities so that players are experiencing things every day. And yes, you want to be reinforcing these, Don. You might be having a 30-second conversation before the activity starts. Once you've given your instructions, you might be saying, right, guys, remember ants? So this is the beauty of the academy. Sorry, I don't want to get too pitchy here, but this is the beauty of the academy, is a lot of the coaches who are using it have done a classroom session where they've played the videos and they're all whiteboard animations, so they're fun and they bring the stuff to life. So they do the whiteboard animation. Then the class, all the players have a conversation about, say, ants and game face, and then they take it out onto the pitch with them. And every single activity, they're striving to squash ants. And it's not just, here's the thing, guys, it's not just the coaches who are being insistent on it. It's actually promoting teamwork. It's promoting teamship, because they're reinforcing the notion of players helping each other to squash their ants. They're reinforcing the notion of players helping each other stick to their game face. So if you've got a couple of centre-backs there, back there, right, you want your centre-backs to have a conversation each week about how they're going to help each other stick to their game face. You want to have a you want your centre-backs to have a conversation, in fact, all of your defenders, to have a conversation about how they're going to help each other squash their ants, about what controller they like to use, about their preferred way of communicating on the pitch to be able to stick to their game face. That truly is teamwork with a mental skills bent to it, but it's teamwork. But back to this notion of skills, Don, it's doing it every day in every single session. And that also answers yours question, Chris, slightly, is that, well, are you going into training striving to improve being better from a mental skill perspective? You probably weren't, and you probably aren't. So I would be saying we need to spot, stop, and squash ants quickly in activities. When we do that in activities, we'll get better at doing it on the pitch on match day. Last thing to say here, Don, you're quite right. I could talk for not England, I could talk for Europe about this stuff, right? And I know I get a bit carried away, but you're quite right. Let's cut it back. When I'm talking to coaches about the academy, or I'm talking to coaches that I work with one-to-one here in England, or even in the States on Skype, I'm often saying, let's pick three or four skills that you are going to put into your coaching curriculum that is the foundation of the mental skills you want. So I've got, when I talk to coaches, some coaches will say to me, Dan, you know what? Match script, game face, that's enough for me. I'm really happy with that. I'll have other coaches who will say, game face, ants, match script, great. I'll have other coaches who will go, I want controllers, ants, script, game face. Some have two, some have three, some have four. But you gotta have something. And this is my big bugbear, is that even in the Premier League, they don't have anything. And so everybody on a Monday morning, going into the club that you work at, everybody's like, well, we've lost and we're bemoaning that. We've won and we're delighted. But but there never seems to be an appraisal, an analysis, a reflection on the mental skills of the weekend. We lost. Let's give ourselves a mark out of 10 for our mental skills. What was our game faces like? What was our controllers like? Were we squashing our ants? We won. How good was our, were we in our game face to help us win? Let's talk, let's have a conversation about that. So that's vital as well. But you're right, Don, you've got to strip it back, know exactly what you're doing from a mental skills perspective. It cannot be a mishmash of stuff, in my opinion.
So when you go into Bournemouth, are you allowed to, I'm not sure if you're allowed to say this, but like, do you work individually with everyone and analyze the last performance or as a team, or how does Bournemouth do things differently to maybe other teams that you kind of mentioned?
I suppose I can talk a little bit about this. I mean, I would say much of this is proprietary, so I do need to be sensitive with that. But what I would say is my role predominantly functions through the medical department. And anybody who knows anything about sport, I suppose, elite adult sport, is the medical department is always a hive of activity. And so I do get to communicate with, sit down with all of the players, not from a group perspective, but from an individual perspective. So I've certainly worked with just about every member of the Bournemouth team, and sometimes you're sitting down more with a player and then less with another player, and that shifts around. So I do try to keep things consistent with players. I always try to say to them, look, come and have a chat with me for 5-10 minutes each week. Worst way. Others like a little bit more. And that's how I really conduct it. But there were a good, of a squad of 25, I would say there's at least 15 players who would have a game face, who certainly know about ants, who know about controllers and might have a preferred controller, essentially. I'm really passionate. I'm a sports psychologist who's really passionate about skill acquisition as well. So I'm in a fortunate position to be able to observe training and give my thoughts to the coaching staff and feedback on that side of things as well. So that's how it functions. Every club is different. And I would say at Bournemouth, I predominantly work with individuals on their mindset, more so than an integrated process, if you like. That makes sense.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Is there any, I mean, I listen to all of this and I think a lot of this stuff is obviously transferable to real life as well. So for example, like the night before I go to bed, I always write down a list of stuff I've got to do tomorrow. And if I don't do that, the next day I'm a shambles. It takes me forever to kind of work out what I've got to do in my life. So it's kind of mentally preparing myself. But I'm hearing a lot of stuff like squashing the ants and game face and stuff like that. You can actually do in real life as well. Maybe I'm wrong there, but that's obviously, there are obviously no, things like that.
You can't, yeah, 100%. I strive to squash my ants and I don't always succeed. And sometimes I say to myself, you know what? I'm turning down the volume there from about 7 out of 10 to 2 out of 10, and that's good enough. You know, I've still got some lingering doubts about a certain situation, but that's okay. I'm managing myself as best I can. And I, if I may also comment on what you've just said, though, I love what you've done there in terms of writing a list down the night before the night before the next day, if you like. You're sort of diarizing, you're writing a schedule, and that's a lot to do with personality characteristics as well, Chris. I mean, organizing your days is a lot to do with conscientiousness, the personality trait of conscientiousness. So we have, as human beings, we have 5 major personality traits. It's called the Big 5 in personality science, one of which is conscientiousness. So conscientiousness is essentially achievement and being orderly. So what helps you be more high conscientious, what helps you be more orderly, is to write lists, to write a schedule. That's a very, very good strategy that you've engaged in to help you be more orderly. That's a nice little thing you've done there, mate.
I just thought, yeah, I thought maybe because I got a bad memory as well.
Don't fool yourself. Dan, Chris was just looking for a pat on the back. Well done, Chris.
Yeah, really. I wake up every morning going, what shall I do today? What shall I do today?
Then I like your strategy to be able to increase your confidence. So yeah, no, that's
exactly. I like that.
But there's a wider issue there, in as much as, you know, Chris, you could be, and you guys might have seen my debates that I've had about attitude, effort and energy, for instance, and the 20th century message of insisting that players insisting on great attitude and insisting on 100% effort and energy. And I actually think that the 21st century coach is the coach who has a knowledge of mental skills to help players develop their mental skills to be able to demonstrate a great attitude, to be able to engage in 100% effort and energy. I think those are mediated by mental skills and personality characteristics. I think that's the 21st century coach.
So you're saying everyone's different there. So you have to kind of look at everyone individually, how you're going to make them have a quote unquote good attitude. Because is there a set good attitude, or is it like, is everyone different in their good attitudes? Does that make sense? It's kind of like, I'm trying to comprehend what you're saying there, really.
I think you've done it really well. I think you're understanding me. What I'm saying is everybody has their life challenges. We can't simply insist that players have a great attitude. What we can do is create an environment, a culture that promotes great attitude, that gives players the best opportunity to have a great attitude. And those cultures and environments that do that will engage in mental skills, will engage in helping players develop their personality characteristics, will engage in psychological safety. So giving players the opportunity to talk about their vulnerabilities, for instance, that's related to psychological. We might actually develop a psychologically informed environment. What a psychologically informed environment is it's an environment that appreciates that everybody is different. Everybody has different experiences, different personalities, different needs, wants, hopes, doubts, beliefs, fears, etc. And engages in discourse and engages in behaviors that allows for individual differences, as you've alluded to there, Chris. That's absolutely essential. So I'm saying there's a disparity between the 20th century message of, well, I insist that you have a great attitude. The 21st century message says, we understand you are human. We understand you have different personality characteristics. We understand that you have different needs, wants, hopes, doubts, beliefs. We understand that anxiety happens to you. Doubt, worry happens to you. Fear happens to you. Low mood happens to you. Hostility can happen to you. Depression can happen to you. We are going to produce an environment, a culture that enables you to manage yourself better. Now, what I'm not saying is that bad attitudes are a good thing, or that we allow bad attitudes to happen. What I am saying is that the 21st century coach and coaching group has the skills to help players in these areas, and they're not just insistent in players being impeccable in these areas. That is the difference that I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, I know Don probably wants to jump in with a few questions, but just quickly, kind of just leading on from that, it's kind of a controversial thing, maybe what I'm about to say, but maybe not. But going into society these days, everyone's weaker-minded, and the kids of this generation, they just can't handle anything and stuff like that. I'm not a complete believer in that. I think just things are more amplified these days with social media and stuff like that. But what do you think, like, dealing with on the sports side of things, do you think over the last 10, 15 years, however long you've been involved in this industry, so to speak, what do you think's changed, or has nothing changed? Or I'm just interested to know what your thoughts are on that.
I think you're right. I think social media makes a big difference. Absolutely. I think knowledge is on our fingertips now. So things like mental skills, personality characteristics, emotional intelligence, social intelligence, if we are going to use those other two forms of intelligence in inverted comma, are more pertinent these days and are highlighted more. But I think that also, let me come back to this notion of knowledge. We have more knowledge now. and we understand human beings better now. I don't think we can get away anymore with, well, the player knows it or doesn't know it, or the player's just got to do it, you know, or the player can't do it. Everybody can go on Google Scholar these days. Everybody can go on Amazon and order books related to human functioning. And we have a much broader knowledge of how human beings function. And I think as a consequence, we just need to be better. I think it's a really interesting question. I please excuse me if I'm struggling to answer it coherently.
No.
Because I think they're clearly generations, things do change. And perhaps right now I'm struggling to articulate accurately what that might be.
Yeah.
But I think there are things that haven't changed. And I think that back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, the way we coached back then, there wasn't the knowledge base. There wasn't the access to mental health, well-being, welfare, articles, books, resources, mental skills, performance psychology resources. And so there was more of an acceptability or more of an excuse for saying, well, he or she just doesn't have it, or he or she is just weak and isn't mentally tough enough, tough in inverted commas. I think that because there is a lack of resources back there, or there were less resources, then we could just say that and that was okay. Now, more and more, I can speak for the UK, that's not acceptable anymore. For example, the case of British Cycling, that's been one of the most successful medal-winning programs in all sports globally, but has been seriously chastised and seriously changed as a consequence of the way they went about getting the medals, which was allegedly putting athletes in harm's way. And what we were saying is, still strive to win gold medals, but do so in an optimal fashion. Do so with well-being and welfare policies in place. Do so with a mental health policy in place so that your cyclists, your athletes win gold medals and silver medals, get on the podium without their well-being and welfare and mental health being jeopardized. That isn't acceptable, and that's not optimal coaching. I'm saying optimal coaching is not bullying around attitude, effort, and energy. It's not as basic as insisting attitude, effort, and energy. It's not just insisting that people are coachable. It's being good enough to help people be coachable enough. It's about being good enough to help people have a great attitude, to help people manage the challenges in their life, to help welfare and well-being, to help them optimize themselves as competitors and people. We have to think of the person, the player, and the performer. That is skillful coaching.
Thank you. Well, no, I was just... Yeah, Don, you want to add something there?
Yeah, well, Dan, no, yeah, I love that. I love that. I really do. You know, something comes to my mind, Dan, that I've wondered about for years. It affected me as a player, and it affects almost every player that I know has superstitions, right? So our American audience will know Wade Boggs, you know, a baseball player, played for like 18 years for the Yankees and the Red Sox. And he had to eat fried chicken before every game. You know, he had to go out at 7:17 p.m. and go out for sprints. He had to write the same things with his bat in the batter's box every single time. And for him, it's, you know, whether that was what worked for him or whatever, but it worked for his career, you know. And for myself, I had to put on my left sock before my right sock, and I had to put them on exactly the same way. I'm old enough that I played pre-back pass rule, right? The first play of the game was the team had to pass me back the ball and I had to touch it. And once I touched it, I was fine. If I didn't touch the ball for 10, 15 minutes, I'd start to go nuts. I'd start to just, it didn't settle me. So what's going on there? Because I know a lot of players have superstitions like that. What's really going on there, Dan?
For me, superstitions are an effort to manage anxiety. We're going into a game, it's an anxious situation. And the narrative we'll have on a week-by-week basis is we'll correlate what we did during a game with what we did before the game. And so how superstitions potentially arise, and let's step out of any kind of religious superstition, because that's slightly different, and works on perhaps a deeper belief level. What players will do is they'll sort of say, well, I wore my red socks. Well, not so much socks, because you've got to wear your team colours, I suppose. But I put on my left sock first, as you said, they're done. And I put on my right sock second, and then I had a really, really good game. And so you build a narrative, and that narrative cements a belief, if you like. And that's how it builds. And maybe that's reinforced the following week, where you do the same and you have a really good game. And then you might have a bad game the third week, but it doesn't really matter, because then that might be due to something else. So you engage in an act that correlates to a performance, and then you produce a narrative based on that, and that ingrains a habit, essentially, or a superstition. But here's the thing. So when we do that, it then lessens our anxiety, and whether that leads to a great game. Well, great games depend on lots of variables, and that's the thing. That's why it might not always lead to a great game, but it might not always lead to a great game, because it's correlational and it's not causal. It's correlational and it's not causal. So what I would always do, if you're inviting me to give you an answer, and I think it's interesting, Don, I think if you look back in that final example you gave me was one of the most destructive of all, which you hear from a lot of very, very, very good players. You're in good company, Don. I've sat down with some pretty good players in my lifetime doing this, and you hear about some pretty strong superstitions from some household names, and you scratch your head because you think there's no logical relationship there at all. But that relationship has just been forged in a player's mind. And your notion of, I have to touch the ball in the first 10 minutes. And as you said, well, the first thing I would be saying to you, and what I say to players who say this kind of thing, is, what if you don't touch the ball? A player often says to me, I've got to complete a great pass in the first 5 minutes, or I've got to win a tackle. But what if you don't have the opportunity to? Or what if you misplace your first pass? Were you going to let the rest of the game, that 85 minutes, be dictated by your first initial pass or your first initial challenge? I mean, that's quite, you can have that if you want to, but that's quite volatile, isn't it? So it's really about striving to help players build a routine rather than a superstition. And a routine will be more causal than correlational. It can't be 100% causal, because that's just not the way this works, really. But we can use things like imagery. We can use things like what I would call a match script, which would be to have two or three game cues, actions related to the responsibilities in your role that you can look at. You can be focusing on using your self-talk during your routine. You can remind yourself of that. You can go through certain physical things, but physical things that will actually relate to the physical side of the game. So something that's much more routine-based, that is probably adaptable, Don. You know, rather than it, I've got to do this at 2:30, half an hour before kickoff. The reality is you might not have turned up by that time. Or it might be that the manager wants to do, or the head coach wants to speak to you at that time. So you probably want a routine that's a bit more adaptable, that's as close to causal as can possibly be. So imagery develops confidence. That's not 100% causal. clearly, but it's closer than putting on your socks in a particular order and playing well. And just really based around the kind of mental skills that I spoke around earlier and physical cues and skills that you'll be working on day to day. That's what I would be trying to promote for a player.
Yeah, very nice, Dan. Thank you. Yeah, it's crazy when we see players have to listen to a certain song, and if things go wrong and their iPod runs out of battery, and you'll see them just not on that day. They just don't play well, and it's wild how many superstitions that we come across.
Well, one of the most interesting ones was actually going back to that non-league appointment I had, and we had a new player who came in midway through the season, and his superstition was he wanted to leave the changing room last. There was one big problem. We already had a player who wanted to leave the changing room last. So what ensued was this comedic pushing match, and in the end, I think Wayne, the manager, just stormed back in and pushed them both out at the same time, clattering their heads between them, I think. But yeah, and I can't remember for the life of me how they sorted it out after that. But that's the challenge of something like that. It's right the way down to having to urinate in the same urinal, you know, every single match before they play. There's some stuff, and I don't want to belittle people. I don't want to say it's bizarre, but I think it's not bizarre. It's just dangerous, and it's suboptimal. It's come on, let's really logically break this down, and let's create some impactful routines that can possibly make more of a difference and help you to take charge of you. That's the important thing here. You take charge of you. You start to take control of yourself as much as you possibly can.
So, Dan, as a college coach, you know, I watch these kids. People don't realize what the day of a college player looks like. It's a 50 to 60 hour work week. It's insane. These kids are up at, you know, 5 and 6 in the morning. They're in the weight room. Then they got to head off to 8 o'clock class. Then they come back for 1 o'clock training. You know, by the time you're cleaned up and everything, it's 3:30, 4 o'clock. Maybe you've got another afternoon class, and you've got a maybe team study hall, and then go back and do it all again. And then, you know, Friday and Sunday is the game schedule typically for the NCAA. And it's insane. You know, you get 24 hours to recuperate before you've got to go perform again on Sunday. And oftentimes there's travel. You know, there are teams in this country that'll play on a Friday, hop on a bus, drive for 8 hours, and then have to play again on Sunday. And it's crazy. So in this hecticness, it's hard to find routine sometimes, or the energy, I guess, to do routine. So if there was one thing that you could recommend to a player that's got that kind of a schedule — this isn't a professional schedule, this is more hectic, I think, than a pro schedule.
Great.
What would you recommend to players if there was one thing you said, look, this is what I would recommend that you do to start building this routine, right? This mental skills training. What is there one thing that you could pin down?
Well, look, and you know, putting my psychologist cap on again, if we go back to those personality characteristics, you can end up in a vicious cycle here. So one of the facets of neuroticism, in fact, the first facet of the 6 facets of neuroticism, facet number 1 is anxiety. And so when you go into environment mediates your personality traits and what you experience in life with your personality. So when you've got this 60-hour a week schedule, that can tap into your anxiety, and so you become anxious. Here's the challenge, Don. You become anxious. That actually it de-energizes you and lowers your conscientiousness. So it can lower your orderliness. And so you become, you know, you can forget things, you might succumb to, you know, your resilience drops, so you might succumb to poor diet. A strategy to deal with that might be to drink a little bit as well. So maladaptive behavior, certainly from a sporting perspective there. So there's these links between our personality characteristics, and we can enter into a vicious cycle. And so we eat poorly, and we show up late, and we don't get our homework done, if you like, and we might show up late to class, and we lose a bit of fitness, and so we become more anxious, and then we become more anxious, and our resilience drops even more. And so there's this vicious cycle. And I'm just trying to articulate what you're saying from a psychologist's perspective.
Dan, you've just described every college coach in America listening to this and going, hey, that's half my team right there. You just described half my team, and every team I've ever coached, that there's a handful of players, certainly. And then in your bad years, it's the majority of the team that succumb to exactly what you're talking about.
Well, that what I've given you is the personality science behind it. And personality science is based on energy. It's based on energy. So people who are introverts, by and large, from a very basic perspective, get their energy from inside of them. And people who are extrovert will get their energy more from the outside of them. When people find themselves in a stressful situation, their energy will be driven quite neurotically. So neuroticism is another personality characteristic. So what I'm doing is giving you a bit of science there. The science underpins. So science, in essence, underpins what you're saying, what all those coaches are experiencing, and it leads me to draw this conclusion. You can't afford not to create a coaching culture that engages in mental skills. You can't afford not to help players start to learn where their ants, their automatic negative thoughts might be. Automatic negative thoughts shaped by anxiety, by frustration, shaped by self-consciousness, shaped by vulnerability. You can't afford not to engage in some form of program or some form of framework that can help players manage these better. You can't afford not to help your environment adopt a psychologically safe environment. By psychologically safe, I mean, this is the work of Amy Edmondson at Harvard University, who studied successful organizations. And she said she nearly fell off her chair when results were coming back, and it became apparent that the successful organizations were the ones who admitted vulnerability, admitted uncertainty, and were making more mistakes than other. They were making more mistakes than other organizations. It's just that they accepted those mistakes, they talked about them, and they helped people through those mistakes. And this is where that 20th century coaching goes wrong. It just goes, well, I'm going to sort the X's and the O's because there's no time for anything else. I'm going to sort out my activities, passing activity, keep ball, etc., because there's no time for anything else, and ignores the psychosocial elements and says, well, there's no time for that. And what it leads to is what you've just said, and that's players who can't cope. They can't cope with that 60-hour week. They don't have strategies in place because nobody sat them down and said, this is going to be stressful. At times, this is going to be incredibly tough. We have to work together to understand what parts of this are going to be tough for you. And I would almost say rule number one is you need every single player, almost a critical essential, is every single player sitting down on a Sunday night with a timetable for the week ahead, knowing what that week looks like, knowing, having a schedule, and knowing what their challenges are going to be, and knowing how they're going to deal with it, how they're going to squash their ants, how they're going to cope with that timetable. That is absolutely vital. then you give them a better chance to walk onto the pitch to perform how you'd like them to perform. But my answer, Don, is you can't afford not to be engaged in the psychosocial elements, and you can't afford not to put the psychosocial elements first.
So, Dan, here's something it's popping up, at least in the United States, it's popping up quite a bit, talking about coping mechanisms. And I think it was, I think it was at the convention, maybe in Los Angeles, and I think it was the Toronto FC, called called him the mental strength trainer, I think is what they called him. And he was talking about meditation and introducing this to the players, using, I think it's called Muse. They put it on their head and it measures brain waves and it shows the players, you know, what's going on in their head, being able to calm down those negative thoughts. And what are your thoughts on meditation and where it might be coming in?
Yeah.
Have you noticed it? Players working with it? I don't know what's going on in England with it, but what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think meditation in the form of mindfulness is becoming more popular with apps like Headspace and Calm. I think those are the two biggest apps. Obviously, there's been some publicity. Headspace are very somewhat vociferous in getting themselves out there and working with sports teams, and that's fine. I think they're great. I think mindfulness is great if you want to do it. And it's an intervention if a player wants to do it. I personally, it's a tool, if you like. I think that it's something for, I personally believe it's something for welfare and well-being more than anything else. So I think somebody engaging in mindfulness on a daily or every other day basis, I think that can be really useful for welfare and well-being. And there's some evidence. There's some very, and you'll have to excuse me because I don't know the statistics off the top of my head, but I think some evidence out there to suggest that mindfulness is effective for lessening anxiety. I think the jury's out in other areas. I personally believe, if I may say, that the jury is out with the relationship between mindfulness and performance, other than that correlational notion of, if my well-being and my welfare is better, then I've got a better chance to perform. Fair enough, but it's correlational and not, there's no causality there, essentially, in my opinion. So I think it's good. I don't think you can force everybody to do that. I think it can be a part of an individual's mental framework, for sure. Absolutely. And I think it can be a really impactful part. And I've certainly recommended that players use one of the apps to help them clear their mind on a day-to-day basis and just become a bit more experiencing, become a bit more experienced at directing their attention, because that's what mindfulness is and meditation is. It's essentially the capacity to pay attention. And that might be paying attention to your outside world, or it could be paying attention to your inner world and lingering on what you're attending to. Now, the argument that advocates of mindfulness would have, the people who say it helps performance, is they'll say, when you sit down quietly and you direct your attention in a certain direction, you pay attention to that, and you notice when it shifts, and then you gently strive to shift it back onto where you were before, just that's a skill. That ability to notice where your attention is and to redirect it. And that can relate to what you're trying to do on the soccer pitch, to pay attention, to direct your focus of attention. So that's what keen advocates of mindfulness would say, the people who say, hey, there's a relationship here between mindfulness and performance, which is fine, great. There may well be, but certainly for mental health, for welfare and well-being, there's a strong relationship there, in my opinion.
Well, I tell you what, it's crazy. I've been looking into this because it's been fascinating to me. And when you see guys like, I think it's David Vago, he's done fMRI studies, functional MRI studies of the brain, and those that have been practicing meditation for long periods of time, they can see an increase in certain parts of the brain that are more responsible for calmness and focus, and then in a decrease in activities of the amygdala, the parts of the brains that are responsible for the fight or flight and the crazy, you know, thoughts that we have that don't really, it's not reality, it doesn't exist, there's nobody, you know, after you, but it makes you feel like you're more anxious. And so, you know, scientifically, I think, aren't we getting to the point where we're starting to be able to show that this is real?
Yes and no. No, because you can't stick an fMRI on anybody on the pitch. Right. And that's a big problem. So contextually, you can't, the causality there is well, low. So you can't, it's very difficult. I'm trying to articulate myself here. It's hard to reject the null hypothesis on that one. It's difficult to create evidence for mindfulness and meditation improving performance because you can't stick fMRI on a player on the pitch. There's too much movement. We don't have the technology yet. However, Don, look, I mean, there's a difference between the world of academia and the world of being a practitioner and doing what can be useful. And I think if people are able to quieten their mind in the comfort of their own armchair and pay attention effectively, and there's a relationship there with their brain functioning, the brain waves that they're producing, because I think it's a difference between alpha and beta brain waves. That's not it. I believe it's that. Then I think what we're doing at the moment is we're just correlating that to performance.
Right.
It's you have to remember on, and you guys know better than me, because I haven't played soccer. Soccer is a game of visual exploratory behaviors, VEBs, which was a term coined by Dr. Geir Jordé from the Norwegian Institute of Sport. So visual exploratory behaviors are, as the name suggests, scanning. We're looking. We're searching for clues in our environment. And one could argue that the very best players in the world are the ones who see the subtle clues and act very quickly on those subtle clues. You know, it might be the speed of the ball going into a player. So you might see that, and you might detect that speed of the ball going into the player is going slightly slower than normal, and you therefore can make a decision based on that information, the speed of the ball, and you actually close your man down quickly, you press quickly, and you make a challenge. Others might see the speed of the ball quick, and so you know to keep a bit of a distance between the player and yourself. So really, soccer, like all team invasion sports, like basketball, something like that, it's begins at visual exploratory behaviors. So we really need to be able to stick an fMRI on somebody who's engaging in visual exploratory behaviors in a chaotic environment where the landscape is changing all the time, every single millisecond, essentially. And then we will really be able to tell whether mindfulness is an effective form of intervention. But hey, it's interesting.
Wow. Yeah. Boy, there's so much here, Dan. And you know what? I'm really glad that we're going to be able to digest all of this and then come back with you again in January.
I'll explain more. Yeah.
Sorry, Chris. Yeah.
No. I jumped in on you. I apologize. No, I was going to say I'll explain that at the end, just because people forget. Yeah. Dan, question.
I'm really looking forward to joining up with you guys in January. So let's hope we get it done.
Yeah. Thank you, Don, for that. That was interesting to listen to. Actually, I was writing some notes down, but I'm going to jump in with some questions. One, I always listen to a guy called Gary V, if you've ever heard of him, the entrepreneur.
Gary Vaynerchuk.
Vaynerchuk.
Hope you wear your earmuffs for that one. He's very...
He always, like, gives a lot of advice. A lot of it's very good. And he always says, like, in his keynotes, 99% of you or 95% of you here will not do what I'm going to tell you to do. Do you have that problem? Is there anything that you speak more as not individual basis, but more generically to teams? You'll give them the advice and you can tell everyone what to do, but is there certain things that people don't even... Is there like one thing or certain things that infuriates you really that they don't do?
massively, because there's a difference between knowing and doing. And
exactly.
One of the challenges I've got, if I'm working with an organization, and these aren't integrated into the culture, these ideas, and they're more isolated. There's a difference between knowing and doing. There's a difference between integration and isolation. And a big problem with psychology, sports psychology historically, has been that sports psychology has been isolated. So there's the sports psych over there, go and speak to him. And so the ultimate, and this is where the academy is so powerful, if I may say, is that it offers, you know, it gives players videos, it gives parents videos as well, but that's more for the club side of things. But it gives players videos. But as I've said to this, you know, the dozen coaches who have signed up for this season, I said, look, it's number one for you and your coaches. Number one for you and your coaches. You know, it's number one for you and your coaches to learn about a game phrase, ants, match script, etc., for you to integrate this into your coaching practices, day-to-day practices, and your coaching communication. Because when you don't integrate it and it's just isolated and you're like, oh yeah, the players can watch it and they can just get on with it, it's not going to be effective, but it's not going to be as effective as if the coaching staff are going, yeah, we're here, we're in this, we're going to do this, we're going to integrate this, this is going to be an everyday thing. And so my frustration in life, and look, all jobs have their different frustrations. If I have a frustration, it's that it's not integrated enough into the day-to-day sessions and activities and language. And so impacting change can be tougher. It can be tougher. And so when it is integrated, then it makes it much easier. So you often find that you talk to players about, say, you know, you help them create a game phrase. Not all the time, Chris. I mean, I would say the majority of the time, I don't know, let's put a random figure on it. 75% of the time, I'll sit down with a player and we'll talk about game phrase controllers and ants and high performance mindset, HPM, and they'll take it away and they'll have my support and they'll go and do it. And they don't need any coach on the training pitch to reinforce it. I think there's definitely, even with all of those players, if there's a coach on the pitch who's reinforcing it, you know, if a player is dominant and relentless with their game face, that's their game face. If a coach right next to them is saying, come on, I want to see this dominant and relentless. Come on, I want to see you do this keep ball dominant relentless. When I'm watching you, I want to see dominant relentless. I want you to imagine there's a camera on you. In fact, we're going to video this and we're going to watch how dominant relentless you were afterwards. And we're going to mark it out of 10. Wow. Now that's powerful. That's impactful. That changes behavior.
Yeah, I like
ultimately, that's what coaching's about. It's changing behavior. You know, as Eddie Jones, the England rugby coach, used to say to me when I was lead type for England rugby, it's just, you know, we always used to sit in the meeting. We always used to say, how do we change this player's behavior? How do we change this player's behavior? How do we change this player's behavior? And that's often what coaches don't, that's the language they don't often use, is how do we change a player's behavior? And so how do you change their player's behavior? It's not just telling a player what to do. You know, getting solutions for them, it's helping them understand things, but it's giving them an environment whereby they can experience these things. So that can be my frustration. Yeah.
So you obviously you're dealing with a lot of adult age people. A lot of people say like you can't teach an old dog new tricks and all that stuff like that. Do you agree with that, or would you say like this is more of in an ideal world, would you get into kids at a younger age and kind of I don't know how to explain this, but Would you start at a younger age, or is getting into them at adults, is that fine, or is it a lot more difficult?
Look, it's everything. So, I mean, this whole can't teach an old dog new tricks. I mean, there's professional golfers who are playing on a seniors tour who have malleability with their golf swing. So technically, physically, that's not a fact, is it? It just can't be, you know. I think it's a cultural thing. I think it's every sport has its own culture. So you hear this, over here in the UK. Oh, well, no, he's in his 20s now and he can't change it. You're never going to change it. Rubbish. Absolute rubbish. I mean, Rafa Nadal was in his mid-20s in, I think it was 2008, when he had to change his game completely. Not completely, but he changed a few things to be able to compete with Roger Federer on grass. And he beat Roger Federer that year at Wimbledon in the most epic final of all time. Why? Because he changed the way he did certain things. You know, Tiger Woods has changed his swing two or three times and he's had to recently because of injury. It's absolute bobbins, to put it politely, to use a northern
term. I panicked there a little bit.
Yeah, no, it's bobbins, and so that's just not true. However, to answer your question, of course it's great if you're helping a child have a mental skills process. I mean, I think anybody underneath the age of 10, is it absolutely central to have that? Well, the first thing I'd say is anybody underneath the age of 10 probably first and foremost needs to be enjoying the game rather than being pressurized to win or pressurized to develop their game. It's just like, chill out, have fun. You know, they're 9 years old. Let them enjoy soccer for what it is at that age. There's absolute malleability physically, technically, mentally, throughout the teenage years, into your 20s, and so on and so forth. So, yeah. No, I don't agree with that, Chris, at all.
Another question.
I think that's... Sorry.
Dan. No, don't carry on. I've got another question, but I'll follow
up. Honestly, Dan, I was just going to say that's good news for all of us old people that were taught that a leopard can't change its spots. You are what you are. It's only going to get worse when you get older. I think what you just said there is fantastic news for all human beings that want to go through self-improvement, whether it's in your day-to-day life or in the games, yeah?
Yeah, and I think there's a, you know, I'm the last psychologist on earth to be the punch the air, you can achieve anything type of bull that can tend to happen in, say, the motivational guru industry or the self-help industry. And because I think a key strategy for self-improvement is actually knowing who you are, is self-awareness. So please don't get me wrong. It is it's important to know who you are, what your strengths are, what areas you'd like to improve, and have a keen study on how you might go about improving that. And it might be that neurologically and physically, the older you are, the more difficult it is. But I do also think that there is an optimism element to that as well. And this is where it becomes very much an art and not an exact science, is that if you're, I don't know, let's say you're 60 years old and you're just learning golf, if you believe you can learn golf at 60 years old, you give yourself a better chance to learn golf. If you don't believe that you can, then you give yourself a worse chance. That seems to be a fair hypothesis to me. I think realism is fine, but you also want a bit of optimism there as well.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to jump in with a random, we're going to start, finishing up really soon. One of the questions we got asked about maybe three or four times was from people like university students, actually, psychology students. And they said, like, how did you set yourself apart from other psychologists? Like, how did you get to where you are now? Like, what's, obviously there's a hell of a lot of sports psychologists around, but like, what did you do different?
You know, obviously the first answer is the pretty obvious one, which is to work really, really hard. I went and did stuff free, and I fully appreciate not everyone can do that. But I think as long as you're ethical in what you do, there's always teams out there. And no, it's not going to be LA Galaxy, and it's not going to be, you know, the best teams in the world, but it might be your local team in LA, who your local under 13s, your local under 12s. It might be a few coaches there or something like that. Go out and do it. I really believe that. As long as you're honest, as long as you say, I'm still a student, I'm doing this, not going to charge you, I'm not fully qualified, don't tread where you can't, you know, from an ethical perspective. It does tend to be the Wild West out there for that kind of stuff. But I don't think there's anything wrong with that as long as you're honest. So definitely go and do it, because when you go and do it, it's scary. And the more you do it, the less scary it becomes. Because I do think I had an advantage. I mean, I was coaching golf. And when you coach golf, you're doing it 40 hours a week. You know, and you're coaching so many different people, and that gives you a real head start. And then I just went, and as I was a student, I was just doing it with golfers a lot of the time. You know, I was doing psych a lot, and then I went off and I did stuff free, you know, in non-league over here, and it built from there. So I would work very hard, go and do it. I get people who contact me for shadowing, and it's like, well, my work's confidential. I just can't offer that. I'm really, really sorry. I can't. I'm too busy to give up much of my time. So just read my stuff and read other people's stuff and go and do it and go and make loads of mistakes and go and look a fool in front of people. Doesn't matter. Go and do it. And then the third thing I think is write. I mean, I write every day. I write an article that I put on LinkedIn, on Facebook, and drive it through Twitter every day. I say that. I didn't do one today. How about that? I'm going every day.
Why,
and I didn't.
So why
I
are
didn't,
you a liar then? That's the next question. That's the next question, Dan. Why do you lie a lot?
Clearly. I didn't do one virtually every day. But enough to be able to vociferously say every day. And so write, become a good writer. And I sat down and I wrote an ebook that I wanted to give away. And as I was writing the ebook, I was like, oh, I can actually do this. This is okay. This isn't horrendous. And that led me to write four books. And, you know, I'm slowly getting around to writing my fifth soon.
So, available on Amazon, yeah?
Oh, available on Amazon, yeah. Thanks, Chris. And look, I just think it's, yeah. So I think work harder than everybody else. Go and do it early. Be truthful about where you are with your qualifications. Don't lie, and do it ethically. And then the third thing is write. Man, just go out there and write. Yeah.
And what's the biggest challenge there from the start to now? What is the biggest challenge you've come across, and how did you get over that? Like,
it's still going on. It's still going on. It's still not easy to, you know, it's still not easy to get consultancy positions. I think a lot of organizations, certainly in the UK, don't discriminate between sports psychs. I mean, a lot of the clubs are quite happy to get somebody who's, you know, at academy level, who's 22 years old, fresh out of university. And I mean, no disrespect to any young person, you know, but they're very happy to get anybody because somebody's got a degree. And I find they don't always discriminate. There's no way to, it is difficult to stand out. And I know I've got to a point now where I have done, but it's still challenging to get consultancy positions. I'm busy. I'm very, very busy, which is good, but it takes an awful lot of work to get there and to stay there. And that's just because of the nature of sports psychology, because coaches feel they do it. So they don't want to employ anybody because you're the last person on the list from a resources perspective. You know, organizations in sport don't have enough resources. So what happens is a lot of sports psychologists who are fully qualified tend to work in organizational psychology or business psychology, be able to make or work in academia. I mean, I would say most sports psychologists work in academia, which is fine, which is great, which is what they want to do, which is important. But to be a full-time consultant is very difficult. It's very difficult because there's not enough positions out there. There's not enough money out there. Because clubs are going to employ coaches, then they're going to employ physio, then they're going to employ strength and conditioning. Sports psych is the bottom of the list. And that always has been the challenge, and it always will be the challenge.
You think always will be? I mean, obviously you know a lot better than me, but like from a social side of things, society, things are changing with like mental well-being and all that stuff like that. So it's kind of, I thought that translate across to maybe your roles and how that's gonna work, working with players and stuff like that. I thought it'd become more and more important just by awareness.
I don't think importance. Let me take back what I was about to say. Importance does make a difference, of course, but I think that ultimately coaches feel that they do it, and they do, psychology within their role. That's what we've been talking about, right? But they're not sports psychologists per se. They're not psychologists per se. They do psychology within their role. But ultimately, Chris, it just comes down to resources. It comes down to who's first on the list that we've got to pay, who's second, who's third, who's 10th. Psychs will always be 10th. That's just the way it is. It's not to say it's not important. It's very important. But if a club doesn't have resources, it doesn't have resources. And I'd like to think that's where the academy can be really, really brilliant for college coaches, is it's a very reasonable way of putting a program through your program, a mental skills program through your program.
Yeah. Well, I think the brain controls the legs, and if the brain's not working right, then the legs won't work right.
We can have a good debate about brain controlling legs if you want, but that would be another hour. That's about embodied cognition and ecological dynamics. We'll do that in the next one.
I was going to say that. Yeah, that's
we'll do that in January.
Yeah, exactly. Don, last any questions from you, just to kind of wrap things up?
No, Dan. I'd like to kind of wrap it up if you don't mind. With you maybe being able to let our folks know where to, what types of, if they want to get a hold of you, if there's things that they need from you, maybe a college coach is listening to this and says, well, you know, next year I'd like him to be able to work with my team. Is that possible?
A 1,000,000%, Tonya. Absolutely. I'm really excited about how it's gone this year with this dozen, with these dozen coaches.
How has it gone?
So brilliant. Lots of positive feedback. And I think it, at the moment, I haven't got permission to talk about any specific person, but across the board, there's been really positive feedback. And I know, you know, in these circumstances, it's obvious for me to say that, but there really has been. And I'm looking to improve the academy as well with my support and the type of support I give, and as much of support as I possibly can. So I'm really excited about it going forward. But
can you tell us, Dan, is it a variety of division, NCAA, Division I, yeah. Division II, junior college? Is it a different variety? I mean, is there something for everybody here?
Look, for everybody, and everybody has, you know, I think junior college has signed up. We've had Division 3s, Division 2s, Division 1s, obviously Division, you know, the lower you go down, I believe it's a lot to do with resources. And so we had a few colleges at Division 3 who sort of said, yep, we can do that. It's no problem. It's not too onerous, the cost of it. Yeah, look, it's been really, really positive, and I'm looking forward to getting more.
And what are the coaches saying, Dan? Are the coaches saying that they're seeing results?
Yes.
Something different than what's always going on?
Yes, and you'll have to excuse me, because perhaps we can probably do another podcast and talk more about that
when I've
had some more specific feedback, and obviously the results of where people have got to in the playoffs and what have you. From this year, but there's also that I think every single coach has said to me is they've built some foundations this year where they haven't had a mental skills program in before. They've built some foundations, and they've now got a great a rock solid foundation moving forward. So it is in the outcomes, but it's also in the capacity to develop players as well, and just produce the best possible, most supportive program for players that helps them not just with their game, but also with tools for their welfare and well-being. But look, I mean, people can jump onto, college coaches can jump onto my website at danabrahams.com and just click on the academy there, and they can get in all the information. And by all means, I'm always open to having a Skype and showing people actually inside the academy, so we can have a good chat about it and a chat about how it can positively influence your college and your college program. I'm going to be at the USC. Where is it in January? I've forgotten where
Baltimore.
It is. Baltimore. Thank you very much. Sorry, Chris. I'm going to be in Baltimore we're potentially doing something, aren't we? But I'm going to be there for 4 days. And so if anybody wants to collar me and sit down and have a coffee and talk through the academy with relation to their program, absolutely would be delighted to. The website's danabrahams.com. You can follow me on Twitter. I've got 3 Twitter accounts, but the football one, the soccer one, is at danabrahams77. You can follow me on Instagram at abrahamsports. You can follow me on Facebook at abrahamssoccer. And you can get in contact dan@danabrahams.com. So the email is dan@danabrahams.com.
There we go.
Fantastic, perfect. Dan. Yeah, no, thank you.
Thanks.
And for those of you that don't know what USC is, that's the United Soccer Coaches. They changed the name, right? NSCAA, right? They changed the name to United Soccer Coaches. And it's the largest soccer coaches organization in the world.
Yeah.
And that's in Baltimore in January.
Big convention. Everyone goes to it. And we're hopefully going to be doing an evening with Dan Abraham, so to speak, a bit of a seminar. Private thing. So we'll announce more when we get the details nailed down.
Well, awesome.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks for your time, Dan. Really, really, really appreciate everything. Hopefully that's of use to a lot of people. I've really enjoyed it. Don, I know for a fact, will have enjoyed it without even asking him.
I'm in heaven. You're one of my, one of the guys that I always looked up to and how to make all this all work. So thank you, Dan. I really appreciate your work with us.
Thank you.
With our coaches, yeah.
And hopefully Chris likes me even just a smidgen more
than Dan, I've always followed your stuff. I just don't own any books. I've looked at them. I look at your articles every day, though. If that's
buy a book and then that would be 10p coming my way, so I can lavish myself with some kind of 10p gift.
I was hoping for a signed one, actually, but you know.
That'd be much more expensive, mate.
30p?
Yes.
Awesome. All right, Dan. Well, thanks for everything.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, guys.
Right. Cheers, guys.
All right, bye.
Well, that was it. Episode number 3 is done. Thank you to Dan and Don as well, obviously, for joining in. So I really enjoyed it. Took a lot away, from the sports side of things, but even translating things into real life as well. But hopefully coaches, students, players, everyone got a little bit out of it. Obviously, it's a bit of a longer podcast, but it hopefully made your commute, workout, walk, if you're walking the dog, something like that, more enjoyable. So that's it. Yeah, probably the last thing I've got to ask is if you can leave us a review. Subscribe to us. I mean, we're on Apple Podcasts, we're on Spotify, we're on anything, anywhere you can listen to a podcast, we're on there, we're on YouTube. Any sort of positive feedback helps us. It's just subscribing helps get us seen more and stuff like that. Tell your friend, if you've got a friend who might be interested in any of the podcasts we've launched, that'd be really, really appreciated. So yeah, that's it. Thanks very much, and episode number 4 will be coming soon, and hopefully you'll hear from us again. Thanks, guys.